Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway.
I'm worth a million in prizes. Oh, we have a torture film. Drive a GTO. Wear a uniform. A lot of government loan.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about the 1996 Danny Boyle directed movie Trainspotting.
Yeah, we are.
Ooh.
And now, whose list was this on?
Mine.
Okay, so actually, before we get into the movie, I do want to get a quick shout out. Special thanks to listener Matthew from tapemaker.tumblr.com for sending us a link to the ultra rare Miren Cadell track, Home Ec, from 2002. It's, I don't know if you guys have heard it yet, but it's about being in the seventh grade, and it's kind of reminiscent of The Sweater and Spelling Bee. And I will add a link to it in the show notes. So if you read the show notes, either online or probably in your podcatcher, just click on it and you'll go right to it.
Yeah. Well, two things. First, thank you very much, Matthew. That was really cool. Yeah, I'd never heard that before, so that was really great. Second, yeah, apparently you actually write stuff in the show notes, like informative stuff. And I was very impressed last week.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to have to look every week.
Sometimes I take a lot of time putting in links and stuff.
Yeah, you blew my mind.
So, yeah, notes are good. But anyway, yeah, so visit Matthew's tapemaker.tumblr.com page. His page is called A Classic Big Boy with Cheese, and he describes himself as a Long Beach native thrift store ninja in search of the perfect fry. I don't know why I'm doing an ad like he's like we're a dating site for him, but if it works, go to it.
Yeah, a very cool site where he posts a lot of music that's fun to listen to.
Good stuff. So visit it, and thank you again, Matthew. So... Yeah, Trainspotting. Brother Jay, tell us why this is on your list of judgment.
Actually, this isn't on my list of judgment. This is just on my list of movies.
So tell us why you hate this movie.
So I don't know if we've discussed before. Yeah, that's okay. I think I'm old and senile, so I will tell it again anyway.
Excellent.
Especially because now it's tribute more than anything. It was kind of a bittersweet tribute because when I was watching it now, there was a couple things that stood out a little more. They were a little more blaringly emotional than perhaps I would have realized when I saw the movie 20 years ago. So, this movie was one that my friend Debbie and I, who were high school friends, we were close in high school and went to senior prom together and we stayed in touch. And when she moved to Vancouver, Washington, I had moved to Portland. We kind of reconnected after years of being estranged through the college years. And she had, you know, kind of flourished being out of the wings of living with her parents in Anchorage and being a little sheltered. And now she was able to have experienced college and live through that experience. And now she was living in a city and spreading her wings and really discovering all of those things you do when you have that self-discovery of oneness, when you're suddenly living by yourself and looking for a job and looking for a future and all of that. So we reconnected as friends and we decided to have lunch and we talked and we said, hey, let's go see a movie. And those were the days before I even had a cell phone, which seems so counter to today, but you know, I didn't have a cell phone and the internet wasn't everywhere. And we went to the movie theater and looked at movie posters and we couldn't decide what movie to see. Like, well, what movie should we look? So we judged what movie to see based solely on the train post or on the movie posters. So of all the movies playing that week, Trainspotting, and then like, well, that, you know, looked like a funny British film that we might enjoy together. And we like British humor and haha. And
yeah, I mean, it's about trains. What can go wrong?
Well, and it looked like a funny movie from the, you know, the cast and the picture. So what, yeah, what could be, you know, why not? Now, Debbie had grown up sheltered, and her parents were very protective, and she wasn't exposed to a lot of kind of the same diversity of colorful people, perhaps, that if you'd grown up like in Chicago or New York or LA, it might have happened, but not like I'm any more cosmopolitan, because I'm not. But I think perhaps she just was a little more reserved and timid at that point in her life, which she overcame quickly. But I remember watching this movie with her in the theater, and it was a very quiet time. I don't think either of us said a word to each other the whole movie, which is kind of what you do in a movie theater anyway. But when the movie was over, we both walked out of the theater, and we just kind of looked at each other, and I was like, yeah, I'll call you. And she's like, yeah. And so we kind of had a very quiet parting and kind of had a contemplative day or two before we called each other and talked. But I think the movie was kind of shocking for both of us to have sat through, and probably uncomfortable for both of us to see with one another. But still, I think we both thought it was a great movie. And on rewatch, I still think it's a great movie. So I would equate the experience to if I were to have to go see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo with Mom. I don't think I could do that.
I'm impressed by so many things about that story. Not the least of which is that you saw this in the movie theater, I'm guessing without subtitles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Well, don't forget, I'm quite the Anglophile, so I you know, my Monty Python and my Keeping Up Appearances and all of the Fawlty Towers and all of that British, I'm pretty good at the British and the Scotch and the well, I'm pretty good at picking up on that. As certainly, as I get a little bit older, my hearing's not as good, so it gets a little difficult sometimes. But like Snatch is a great movie, but you have to really pay attention to it. The same way Gosford Park is a great movie, but you have to pay attention to it because the dialogue is tight, but not always what you expect.
Well, there's lots of slang too.
Yeah, I saw this movie on video after it first came out. And I enjoyed it, but it was such a richer experience when I could watch it on DVD with subtitles and understand more than maybe 50 to 60% of what they were saying, especially Bigby. Holy crap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't remember the first time I saw this, but it was probably in that time when I was watching lots of what I would consider more indie films like Henry Fool and what's a good other good example, but basically anything that Parker Posey's ever been in. So I think this would probably fit along those lines. But I just remember it. I mean, obviously there are parts that we'll talk about that are fairly off-putting upon first watch, but the dialogue is so great and the story is so great. Not necessarily fun, but it moves along so well that I just really, really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed it again watching it just for this.
It's a pretty powerful morality tale because it doesn't glamorize heroin use. And some of the consequences are not unrealistic.
Oh, no. No, not at all. I mean, I think at least in, well, I think probably all parts of the world, but in our little part of Alaska, which is way on the edge of our little part of America, we've got like a pretty serious heroin problem now. And so all of these things that he talks about, he kind of alludes to more than talks about it toward the end, where they're, you know, going into nursing homes and stealing TVs and things. That's all real stuff that happens. And like stealing like fentanyl patches off of elderly patients.
It's so brazenly bold.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the worst. And that you have to, you know, if you've got a habit like that, you got to feed it. So you got to be, you know, it's like prostitution is, has a link to drug abuse, because if you've got a $400 a day drug habit, that's a lot of work you have to do each and every day to support that habit. So that's where you get into things that you can make money quick.
You're not waiting for a paycheck.
No, and that's where you're going and trying door handles on cars, trying to steal stuff and then quickly pawn it, and then just scratch enough together to get, you know, to get your next fix. But anyway, yeah, it does not glamorize actually anything.
No.
And yet I don't know about you, but I can still consider this a very fun movie. Maybe it's the music. Maybe it's because it's hard to dislike Ewan McGregor.
I don't know that it's a fun movie. I think it has some fun parts, because it's a pretty dark movie.
It's dark, but it's really funny.
It's very funny.
It's got a great soundtrack, like you mentioned, Eric. And yeah, the lead character by Ewan McGregor is extremely charismatic. So even when he's doing horrible things, you still like him and you're still... And he's sort of the best of his group of friends. So just on a relative basis, he's like the hero of the movie, even though he kind of ruins his friend Tommy's life. But yeah, no, it's a fun movie, because it does. The music's great. It does move along really quickly. Even though there are some tragic parts to the story, it's all done with such absurdist humor for the most part that it keeps a really heavy subject matter pretty light.
Well, and the fact that he is so, you know, because Ewan McGregor is Mark Rent Boy Renton, and he's the narrator of this little tale as well.
And he narrates it with brazen honesty.
Oh yeah, it's great. I mean, when he talks about stuff. That in such a, I mean, the dialogue is so, actually it would be the monologues are so peppered with, you know, cool turns of phrase and like very dramatic language. I'm not saying it right. I don't have the same dramatic language that the movie has, sadly. But yeah, I mean, there's so many fun stuff in there. And the supporting characters, the supporting actors are also fantastic. And I didn't realize that all of the main actors, except for one, are Scots.
Yeah, you didn't get that from the accents?
Well, no, I can't tell a Scot from an Englishman by looking. I mean, I would assume that they can do some accents.
Was Tommy the one who wasn't?
No, it's Johnny Lee Miller, Sick Boy.
Oh.
And the only reason he got the, well, not the only reason, but the main reason he got the job is because he could do a dead-on Sean Connery accent. And that was important in the book. So, and I have never read the book, and I don't think I want to. Although, have we already talked about T2?
I saw that you posted that there was going to be one, but my brain couldn't wrap myself around it, so I just didn't even look at it.
Oh, if it's not in production, it's in pre-production right now. Pretty much all the surviving cast are game for it. And it's based on the sequel novel called Porno that jumps ahead in time. I think the script, as it is now, has them jumping ahead 20 years.
Well, that's just about perfect.
It's currently filming.
Yeah, see? Amazing.
I was trying to think where Robert Carlyle, where I've seen, what movie I've seen him in.
He's been in a lot of like indie movies. Again, this kind of movie.
The World Is Not Enough.
Mm-hmm.
And The Full Monty.
He's also in 28 Weeks Later.
Also a Danny Boyle movie.
He didn't direct it though, right?
28 Weeks Later he did. 28 Days Later, he didn't.
Well, that seems backwards.
I had jotted down in my notes that we would know him from Shallow Grave. Oh, I guess it is 28 Days Later. Yeah, I guess. Sorry. 28 Days Later is his 28 Weeks. I don't know what I was thinking. Slumdog Millionaire.
I was going with it. You were so confident.
No, it's... Yeah, okay. So Danny Boyle's directed Shallow Grave, 28 Days Later, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours, Steve Jobs, and T2, Trainspotting 2.
127 Hours, is that the film about the guy who had to cut his own arm off?
Yeah.
No, nope, I'm not, nope.
No, I don't want to see James Franco for 127 hours either, even for 127 minutes.
I like James Franco. I like him, so I make up for the fact that you dislike him, so we cancel each other out.
Drew, tiebreaker?
Oh, just like mom and dad voting.
Luckily, politics did not come up once while they were here.
I don't mind James Franco. He can be a bit much. I will not watch 127 hours. His performance in Spring Break was kind of hard to watch. Actually, that movie was hard to watch. I don't recommend that movie. You know what? I don't like James Franco.
Wow. You just had a whole thing right there.
He wasn't very good hosting the Oscars with Anne Hathaway. It made me like Anne Hathaway more.
Yeah, nope. I'm out on Anne Hathaway.
Weren't you the one that told me that Rachel's Wedding was like one of the best movies ever?
Oh, that is a great movie. She's really good in that, too.
Yeah, so
best ever, though. That's not even in the top 15.
So shall we get into the plot?
Probably should.
Okay. So this is set in Edinburgh, and we have Mark Wren is the narrator, and he and his friend Spud are sprinting down Princes Street, pursued by security guards. He has this really nice little monologue about...
Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family. Choose a fucking big television. Choose washing machines, cars, compact displays, and electrical tin openers. Choose good health, low cholesterol, and dental insurance. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose your friends. Choose leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suite on hire purchase and a range of fucking fabrics. Choose DIY and wondering who the fuck you are on a Sunday morning. Choose sitting on that couch watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing fucking junk food into your mouth. Choose rotting away at the end of it all, pissing your last in a miserable home, nothing more than an embarrassment to the selfish, fucked up brats that you've spawned to replace yourselves. Choose your future. Choose life. But why would I want to do a thing like that? I chose not to choose life. I chose something else. And the reasons? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got heroin?
Unlike people who choose life, he decided, why would you choose life if you could choose something else? Like heroin. So the rest of his little crew are Sick Boy, Johnny Lee Miller, who is something of a con artist, and later a pimp, and also he has a unified world theory or whatever involving Sean Connery.
He is the best. It's not just Sean Connery, because he later talks about Bond girls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he knows a heck of a lot about James Bond.
Well, he talks about Bond girls in relation to how it proves that... Sean Connery is the manliest man alive.
It's true. So then we have the clean-cut athlete Tommy, played by Kevin McKidd. And we have sociopath Frank Begbie, played by Robert Carlyle. And yeah, Begbie is great. He's a great character. And it's funny because Robert Carlyle in 2009 told a BAFTA interviewer that he played Begbie as a closeted gay male whose outbursts of violence were due to his fear of being outed.
I could totally see that.
And the author, Irvin Welsh, he confirmed that when he wrote Begbie, the book, he has sort of an ambiguous sexuality. Plus, I think Robert Carlyle said that Begbie is, you know, you can find lots of Begbies. There's plenty of Begbies wandering around Edinburgh. You just try to avoid them when you can.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, Spud, by the way, is Ewan Bremner. And he actually has a pretty impressive IMDb page. He's been in a lot of stuff. Including, I think, what is it? Gods of Egypt? What is that movie? That last Egypt movie.
That's, Exodus, Gods of Egypt, oh. Right?
But he's been in a lot of other stuff. Actually, all these guys have pretty much been in a ton of stuff.
Yeah, this cast is incredible. You know, especially looking back at it, 20 years later, realizing how many other things we've seen the entire cast in. Tommy's probably the most unrecognizable, but even Dad Renton, he's been in a ton of stuff, including Game of Thrones and Sons of Anarchy.
Well, and it's funny because Tommy, poor Tommy, the actor that plays Tommy was like on holiday when they did their final like publicity photos. So he's in none of the posters or publicity photos.
He's just kind of rat raced out.
Yeah. Aww. Yeah.
Not on purpose.
Yeah, not on purpose. Poor Vince Valoof.
And I'm going to assume he's not in the sequel either.
Spoiler. Yeah, so Sick Boy, Spud, and Renton are all heroin addicts who spend their days shooting up in their drug dealer's flat. Their drug dealer Swanee, played by Peter Mullen, is often referred to as the Mother Superior by the guys. And the very first thing you see after the little chase is them all shooting up and kind of describing like what the high is like. But while they're describing it as like the best thing ever, they're in a completely like squalid but shooting gallery, like drug house. So it's got no glamour, that's for sure. So Renton decides to give up heroin. But, of course, he needs one last high to get him through the night. So he goes out to try to score after he's announced that he's going to give up heroin. And he ends up buying opium rectal suppositories from a dealer, Mickey Forrester, who's played by the author of the book Trainspotting. And this is the first of several very graphic and... what's the right word? Artfully shot scenes. Because this is, it's got like ultra reality mixed with like complete surreality. Because of course he describes that heroin gives you constipation, and he's at this point been off of heroin long enough, and the suppositories that he has already inserted hadn't kicked in yet. So, he's no longer constipated, has to find a bathroom in a hurry. And it's so great.
He finds the worst toilet in Scotland.
Well, and at this point, if you haven't read the book, you don't really know what kind of movie this is yet either.
Yeah, because you know, we've got Iggy Pop, and we got fun chase scenes, and...
Yeah, so you're not quite sure where it's going with this, and then you get the, you know, you get the toilet sign, and then you get the superimposed worst toilets, and you know, so you get that whole comedy riff. So you're expecting something ha ha, and you get something ha ha horrific.
Well, yeah, because you know, this could have been any number of regular poop jokes, because of course he's now shat out his suppositories, which he still needs, so he's got to go digging around in the toilet to get them. And there are a couple different ways of pulling that off. Even comedically, there could be other ways of doing it. But this starts out as the most disgusting thing I can even imagine.
It was starkly shocking. Even on rewatch, it just gets to me.
Oh, the bathroom itself, even before you realize what he's going to have to do, the bathroom itself is horrific. It's wretch inducing just to watch it. I mean, it's like they must have spent most of their brainstorming time for the entire movie just trying to figure out how to make this bathroom as disgusting as possible. Yeah, like, oh, you know what would really make it? Let's make the entire floor wet.
Yes.
Just a layer of scummy water over the entire floor.
Oh, wait. In this corner, we need more vomit. We need,
that's right.
We need prop people. We need some more vomit, more corn.
Oh, add a fluorescent light that doesn't quite work.
Yes, exactly. Flickering lights, always the best. And yeah, he literally dives into the toilet all the way in this nice little, again, surreal scene where he's diving down to the bottom to get the suppositories. He shows up back at home all completely drenched still. So yeah, something
wet
happened.
Head to toe.
Yeah.
Squishy shoes and all.
Exactly.
He's got to smell bad.
There's not enough bleach. So then we get his little monologue about relinquishing junk and the items you need for it. And again, it's all like these quick edits in a fun little way as he's talking, where he talks about how he needs tomato soup, mushroom soup, ice cream, milk of magnesia, pornography.
Paracetamol, which is Tylenol for the Americans.
Oh, I did not know that. And then three buckets, one for urine, one for feces, and one for vomitus.
And then some Valium that he stole from his mother.
Yes, who is a completely legal drug addict. And then he's all ready. He's completely good to go. He's nailed himself, literally nailed, like boarded up the door so he can't get out.
Dawn of the Dead style.
Yes, yes. Except for one thing. He just needs one hit to soothe the pain while the Valium takes effect. So he tears through the door and goes to try to find his one last hit. But then he actually comes off it. And then we have this nice little thing about the downside of coming off the junk is he needs to mix with all of his junky friends. And it's not too cool. And like Sick Boy, he came off junk at the same time. Not because he wanted to, but just to annoy him. Which is hilarious.
Yeah, I love the concept that Sick Boy is the kind of drug user who can just stop of his own will and doesn't really seem to be affected by addiction so much. So yeah, so he's just a giant asshole about it.
And then they go into the park and have a very interesting conversation about how actors hit their peak and then it's just a complete road to decline ever after. And all while having a BB gun, which they eventually shoot in the buttocks of some kind of bulldog. What breed of dog is that?
It looked like an English bulldog.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Would you have any other kind of bulldog in this movie?
I don't know.
Than an English bulldog? Come on.
By the way, of course, no dogs were harmed in this film. Let me tell you, the UK treats animal cruelty very, very seriously, which good for them.
Did you run into some trouble on vacation? What happened?
No.
Did they see a fish called Wanda?
Again, those are all gummy fish.
Whatever.
But yeah, the British government takes a strong stance on animal cruelty.
And they clearly didn't watch No Country for Old Men.
Well, did you know, by the way, that in Sweden, you're not allowed to have a single guinea pig. You must have at least two. Because they get lonely.
So what happens when one of them dies?
You must replace it with another one.
That seems like a self-perpetuating...
Well, wait, or can you just kill the second one?
Yeah, okay. You can euthanize the other one.
All right.
So yeah, we have this little fun bit of business, and then we're going to yada yada a little bit. Hold on just a second. Well, the synopsis I actually have, yada yada, is kind of an important thing where you get to see Begbie in all his glory in a pub where he throws a pint glass or some sort of glass mug.
It's a glass stein.
Yes. Like behind his back,
over the rail.
Yeah, he's sitting on the second floor, and he finishes a self-aggrandizing story, and then just takes a last swig of his beer and chucks the glass stein over his shoulder, so that it will fall, God knows where on the first floor.
Turns out it falls and hits a woman in the face, so she is bleeding, and of course, how does he respond to that? But he runs down and.
Begbie didn't do drugs either. He just did people. That's what he got off on. His own sensory addiction.
Lassie got blasted. No cunt leaves here till we find out what cunt did it. Who the fuck are you? Yeah!
I love how he starts to fight with just like this rebel yell.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. He's something of a psychopath. But later, we go to a nightclub with Renton because he's now discovered he's got his libido back. And
yeah, this is after he was hanging out with his buddy Tommy to get the real story that Begbie told.
Yes, yes.
And, while Tommy's telling him the real story, he is pilfering one of Tommy's homemade pornos.
Yes. Which is also very funny, and also, a good callback to the 90s when all the videotapes and rental shops and stuff were still then.
When you could potentially accidentally get a homemade porno back at the video store.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Oops.
So anyway, at this nightclub, he meets a young woman, a spunky young woman named Diane, played by Kelly MacDonald, who was 19 years old. The movie premiered, I think, on her 20th birthday.
Did you just say spunky?
I did. There's a better word for it, but...
Plucky.
Yes, plucky. There you go. So he ends up going home with her, only to find out that the next day, she's a 15-year-old schoolgirl.
Oops.
Yes. And the people who he sits down and has some toast with are not her flatmates, but are actually her parents, which is kind of hilarious.
Did her parents know what was going on?
I don't know.
It's unclear because she made him sleep on the couch out in the hallway. And so it was almost like she had a habit of bringing guys home, but she knew she couldn't have him in her room, except that kind of presupposed that she would never do anything in her room.
I guess. Her parents were a little too cool with the strange dude in their house.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Especially considering that he was clearly older.
Yeah.
So either she does this a lot...
And a skinny, junky-looking guy.
So either she did this a lot, or... They were just kind of in denial, and he was just somebody that she met.
In the meantime, Spud and his girlfriend Gail, who, by the way, had read in Cosmo to make her boyfriend wait 6 weeks for sex, and the 6 weeks are up now, and so she's ready to go, and he's ready to go, except he drinks entirely too much, and maybe even has drugs on board as well. And they end up at her parents' house as well. And it does not go well.
Yeah, and there's all in like a 3 minute span, there's a huge amount of male nudity in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And feces.
Yeah, there's more feces.
Lots and lots of feces.
Was there any female nudity in this movie? Oh, I guess yes. Diane.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it was brief and it wasn't much of it. Sorry, I also yada-yadded through a part where in order to stay on the dole, you have to attempt to look for work. But it's a tightrope that you have to walk because you have to be genuinely trying to get a job, but you can't actually get a job. That would be silly. So Spud goes into a job interview high on like crank or something.
Because he's given some amphetamine.
And again, it's hilarious. It's another monologue that's really funny.
Why did you lie? You would have gotten this interview anyway.
And Good Will Hunting kind of ripped off this scene, right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
He does have that great line about what attracts him to the leisure industry. It's his pleasure. Pleasure for other people's leisure.
In the meantime, you know, Tommy and Renton describes Tommy as, you know, basically like a true blue guy. He doesn't do drugs. He doesn't, he never lies. And, you know, he wouldn't cheat on anybody.
He works out all the time.
Yeah. All he does is work out, watch footy, and, you know, have sex with his girlfriend, Lizzie, who's played by Pauline Lynch. And They have a little trouble. Lizzie has a problem when she discovers that she wants him to put on their tape so they can watch themselves do it as they're doing it. And it turns out to be like the top 10 football goals ever. And
which is referenced between Diane and Mark when they're having sex.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. And it's a funny scene, and then it's followed up by her being pissed and the fact that he thinks maybe it could have gone back to the video shop, so they have to wait in front of the video shop till it opens to see if anything's come back. And so Tommy, who, you know, basically has done nothing wrong, ends up on the short end of this particular stick due to Renton taking the video.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
They all kind of have disastrous nights. I mean, Renton doesn't realize it until later, but he commits statutory rape. Spud passes out and then craps the bed, literally. And, and then Tommy's night is interrupted because his homemade sex tape is gone and his girlfriend's pissed about it.
Well, they were already kind of... it was already kind of a rocky relationship because it was, their anniversary or something? And he had forgotten it.
Her birthday.
Her birthday, yes. And he'd forgotten about it. And when he found out about it, she's like, well, you can just take me out. And he goes, well, I have an Izzy Pop.
Izzy Pop?
I was going to do what Diane did. They have an Iggy Pop ticket. And she's like,
it's me or Iggy Pop.
And I paid for the ticket. And it's around this point, after Tommy and Lizzie break up, that they decide to go out to the countryside and get in touch with the Scottish countryside to cleanse themselves in some way.
I actually wrote down the best thing in this whole movie is this quote.
Doesn't it make you proud to be Scottish?
It's shite being Scottish! We're the lowest of the low! The scum of the fucking earth! The most wretched... miserable, servile, pathetic trash that was ever shot into civilization. Some people hate the English. I don't. They're just wankers. We, on the other hand, are colonized by wankers. Can't even find a decent culture to be colonized by. We're ruled by effete assholes. It's a shite state of affairs to be in, Tommy, and all the fresh air in the world won't make any fucking difference.
Yeah, and that's such a great delivery by future Obi-Wan Kenobi.
So again, now poor Tommy is out in the countryside. Doesn't go so well. So Sick Boy, Spud, and Renton all decide to use heroin again. And so they fall off the wagon. And that's when Tommy asks Renton to shoot him up, basically. And, you know... Brendan doesn't want to do that. That doesn't seem to be a good thing to do. But he's all drugged up and he could use the money.
Poor Tommy.
Yep. Then this big old drug party is, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a wet blanket on the party when a baby dies.
Yeah. That part of the movie wasn't very funny.
No.
No.
No, not at all. It's horrible.
Yeah, and also, I mean, and I'm sure this is on purpose, but you have no idea how long that baby's been dead.
Oh, no, and it's unclear. I mean, it seems to be the general consensus is the baby died of, like, dehydration or, you know, malnutrition, not of, like, being smothered or something.
No, yeah, it was just, like, left in the crib for probably 4 or 5 days or a week or so.
Yeah, that was horrific.
Yeah, I was actually now... that was the one part of this movie that was, I think, the hardest to watch. And I'm not a parent, but I can only imagine that now that both of you are parents, that was probably very difficult to see.
Oh, well, and it's clear that even though it's not stated outright, but Sick Boy was presumably the father.
Yeah.
And this changed him. And everybody's response to this tragedy was just to fuck everything. So the quote is, propelling ourselves with longing toward the day that will all go wrong, because no matter how much you stash or how much you steal, you never have enough. No matter how often you go out and rob and fuck people over, you'll always need to get up and do it over again.
Well, I think they're all wanting just to self-medicate, and it's clear that the moment that they're all acknowledging that the baby's dead, they all just want to shoot up.
Yeah.
Rather than deal with it, they're just like, nope, not going to deal with it. Just going to get high.
And then we kind of reach the first scene of the movie, where in their kind of crime spree, that's when Renton and Spud are caught by the security guards on that street, and they have to go to court. And Renton, this is like his first offense, and he's entering a drug treatment program. Spud, it's not his first offense, so Spud has to actually do some real time out of this. So you see that Renton's having a problem not being one of the gang, and yet is happy he doesn't have to go to jail.
Yeah, but not happy he can't do drugs anymore.
Oh no, because now he's on his program, a methadone program, which, by the way, I don't know much about the methadone program, except that a lot of heroin users think that methadone is like the worst ever, because methadone clinics get paid to give methadone to people, so they jack people up in these really high doses of methadone. So they're never really weaning them off. So the only choice is to keep paying the clinic or to go and actually score some heroin.
Well, and I think the days of methadone clinics are largely declining, but we still have clients that take methadone as maintenance dose, but it's not intended as a maintenance dose.
Well, yeah, the idea is to wean you off of heroin.
Yeah.
So actually, right. Let me take a brief break here.
So how is driving the Expedition? That thing looks pretty sweet.
I'm so glad not to drive it.
Is it a beast?
It's too big for me. It's way too big. And, you know, I was terrified anyway, because I'm just like, as I picked it up from the dealership, I was thinking, why did I volunteer for this? Because I'm driving to the airport thinking, I'm going to get a rock chip in the windshield or scrape the fender. Or, oh, God, like, why am I doing this? Why? Why did I agree to this? Why is this a good idea? So I'm driving from the dealership to the airport, and Derek's in my car behind me because we weren't sure if there was going to be enough time that the parents were going to want to go to the hotel before we went to dinner. And then also we thought we would surprise the folks. So he was going to park my car in kind of an obscure dad's car, so dad couldn't really see it till the last minute. But as it turns out, where I parked, there was no way, because there was nobody else anywhere on the roof parking. So I was like, oh, well, this isn't going to work. But as it turns out, dad and mom had had enough tequila on the plane that when they got off the plane, that dad wasn't okay to drive. He probably was okay to drive, but he didn't think he was okay to drive, but he was tired from flying. And so it never occurred to him that his vehicle was there. So when the two vehicles were parked next to each other, he saw mine and I handed him the keys, and he thought I was trying to get him to drive my Explorer back. And I was like, no, this is the key to your new car. And he was like, oh, okay. I'm like, your new car is right there. He's like, it is. And then it dawned on him. And he was like, oh. And so then we had like 10 or 15 minutes where he was, you know, he's like, it's so nice. So
basking in the glory of his new vehicle.
Yeah, it was actually really kind of sweet. So it was nice. And then I had to still drive it the rest of the day. So, you know, and I'm terrified. It's so big. It's just, it's too much for me. So I was never so glad to drive my own vehicle again. And so we went to the hotel, checked him in, went to dinner, came back to my house. And then they just said, well, we'll just leave the Expedition at your house tonight, and you can take us back to the hotel and then pick us up tomorrow and take us to the dealership. So I told Derek, I'm like, okay, I'm taking the parents back to the hotel in my vehicle, because I can't handle, you know, I've been up all day and now I'm driving in the dark, and I know my vehicle now. I don't want to drive this big Expedition at dark at night when I'm tired. If I'm going to wreck something, I'd rather wreck my vehicle. So, no, it all went well. As it turns out, they actually gave Dad an extra $1,000 rebate that he technically wasn't entitled to, but they gave him the rebate anyway. I think part of it for the trauma of the engine block heater. So,
There was a problem with the engine block heater?
As in, there was not an engine block heater.
The saga of this whole, the whole saga, the salesman that Dad got, which is the salesman I had, was a total doofus. And his level of incompetence is probably exemplified in the statement that he no longer works for the dealership, is how bad he is. But as it turns out, the guy that took over is kind of the lead internet sales manager, and he was trying to take over, and he thought that the old salesman had taken care of everything and was just kind of reviewing things with Dad. And, you know, when it turns out that Dad said, well, don't forget the engine block heater has to be installed, I went out and looked at the vehicle, signed off on the vehicle so that the shop could take it and install it. And when he went to contact parts to get it installed, parts said, well, nobody ordered the part. And so the sales guy was like, well, order the part. We need it installed right now. Well, as it turns out, nobody stocks those parts in Oregon because nobody puts engine block heaters in their cars in Oregon because it doesn't get that cold. So he had to order one, but Ford only authorizes them from the Detroit Manufacturing Assembly because they're the only ones who have those kind of cold weather parts. So as it turns out, they couldn't get the part in time to get it here and installed before Dad was leaving. So basically they worked out an arrangement where Dad's going to have it installed at the Ford dealer in Anchorage. So
probably the Ford dealer in Wasilla.
Yeah, not the one in Anchorage.
No, we've actually kind of convinced Dad to try the dealer in Anchorage. So, but he's not paying for it.
Yeah, well, good. Nor should he.
So that worked out. And, he obviously kicked the salesman around for a while, which was kind of satisfying. But he didn't make him cry like the Midas guy, so...
He's mellowed with age, our father.
Yeah. So it was good.
Wait, here's the really important question. Did all of their stuff fit in the expedition?
Oh, yeah. Plenty. They have plenty of room. Now, God knows what else they were getting after leaving here, so I don't know about that. But no, everything they had fit fine. That's a huge vehicle. It would have fit. They could have bought an Explorer, and it would have fit their needs.
Here's the second most important question. How did Dad enjoy Deadpool?
He didn't watch it.
Oh, all right.
Back to the movie. So Spud's in jail.
Right.
And Renton is on this methadone program, but he's taken all of his methadone early that morning and won't, he'll have well run out by the time of his next dose. So he needs to go and try to score in the meantime. And he ends up at Swanee's flat, where he takes a particularly strong dose after a great little bit of dialogue between Renton and Swanee about serving him his drugs. But that's where he nearly overdoses. Or he does overdose and nearly dies.
As a little Peter Mulan tangent, have either of you seen the limited series Top of the Lake?
No, but I've heard about it.
It's great. I recommend it. He's in it. He's almost unrecognizable, but fantastic. As maybe a villain...
His name is Matt in Top of the Lake.
Top of the Lake. Okay, I will put it in the notes.
I will look for it in the notes.
Anyway, so this is where Renton's parents decide to lock him away and just have him go cold turkey. And this is where we get his going through withdrawal symptoms.
Like in his childhood bedroom with like locomotive wallpaper.
It's so trippy. It's so awesome.
Well, it's really great, like use of like camera angles. But pretty much everybody he knows is kind of visiting. Plus, there's also an entire game show. I'd forgotten this whole aspect of it. This entire game show where Dale Winton, who apparently is a game show host in the UK, is asking his parents in a quiz show questions about HIV.
Yeah, which is pretty progressive for the time.
Well, that's the thing, is that this is what happens with heroin users in 1998. And maybe today too, because, you know, you share needles and it's a really easy way to transmit HIV.
Yeah, this movie came out right in the middle of like the AIDS panic, you know, where we had enough of an understanding about HIV now to realize that anybody could get it, depending on your lifestyle choices, and there still was no cure and no real great treatment for it. So it was a death sentence at the time. Not so much anymore, but...
Yeah, well, as long as you have health care.
Right.
But yeah, luckily, Renton's HIV test comes back negative. So he's very pleased about that. Dodged a bullet. But turns out Tommy's HIV test does not come back negative. And Renton goes and visits Tommy. And yeah, he's living in squalor also. And then Diane shows up at Renton's house, whatever, and pretty much encourages him to move to London to get his shit together. Because he just can't sit around and get high and listen to Ziggy Pop. Who's dead, right?
Still not dead 20 years later.
Yeah, so he goes to London and he becomes like some sort of property rental agent. And he's sober and he's doing just fine.
And Diane writes him a letter.
Yeah.
A letter.
I know. It's crazy quaint.
I know. It's so... A letter.
Yeah. And then, of course, because this is the kind of movie that this is, everything goes wrong. And Begbie shows up having committed an armed robbery. Although he says, hey, it's not an armed robbery if it's a replica gun.
and it's shit jewelry.
Yes. So... He just basically takes over Renton's flat.
He becomes the worst roommate ever.
Oh, yeah. And then Sick Boy shows up. They sold his telly.
I can't believe you did that.
I got a good price for it. Rents, I need the money.
It was my fucking telly!
Oh, Christ, if I'd known you were going to get so humpty about it, I wouldn't have bothered.
His telly that was leased.
Yes, exactly.
So he's making payments on a TV he doesn't own that they sold.
Yeah, that's a great scene where they're all sitting around the spot where there used to be the television eating fish and chips.
Yes.
If I know you'd mind, I wouldn't have done
it. He's like, hey, I got a good price for it. And then it steals his fish, too. Yeah, these are the worst roommates ever. So, yeah. Renton decides he's going to basically dump his friends in a vacant apartment. And that's what he does. So, yeah. So, he basically dumps his friend at this flat. But then they hear about Tommy's death. There's real consequences in this movie.
Yeah.
And that's where we have... It's a great scene at the funeral where he explains toxoplasmosis.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing about the cat is the kind of humor that this movie is all about.
Yeah, the kitten survived just fine.
Yeah.
Then they go back home and they meet Spud, who's been released from prison. And Sick Boy suggests a dangerous but profitable heroin transaction. And Sick Boy needs... some of Renton's money to buy this quantity of drugs that they're going to sell.
Kind of resell.
Yeah. They'll be the middleman.
This seems like a really raw deal for Renton.
Oh, yeah. No, it's horrible for Renton. And Renton has already had to get a safety deposit box for his passport since they've already talked about selling his passport.
Yeah. Why? What do you need it for?
Exactly. So they go and they sell these drugs, and they have to test the purity, so that's where Renton has to shoot up again. And then they all go to a pub to celebrate. They've turned 4,000 to 16,000 pounds, and they're all friendly and happy and getting pissed, and that's when the noir part of this thing kicks in again. Renton starts looking at that bag of money and thinking about doing a runner. And actually kind of gives the the nod or the eye to Spud to suggest, hey, you know, what you up for it? The sick boy's gone to the bathroom and Begbie is going to get the next round of drinks. And they don't quite act fast enough. And sick boy comes back. And that's when Begbie bumps into another bar patron and spills a beer.
Probably on purpose.
Yes. And during this whole thing, I mean, Begbie is super violent and is always whipping out this knife that he is almost stabbing everyone. So he ends up slashing Spud's hand with a knife in this little fight. And this is about when Renton decides this group of guys is not long for this world and too much trouble. And he's going to do a runner with this money. So he's, after everybody's asleep, he gets up and he's taking the money, and Spud notices him leaving, and they have this like meaningful eye contact. But
it's so sad. Spud doesn't want him to go.
Yeah.
Because Spud's, and it's such great acting because there's no words exchange, but you know exactly what he's saying. Like, don't do this. Don't go. Don't do this. Don't do this to me. And Renton's like, gotta do it, man. Come on. Come with me. Come on. Come on.
No. There's no offer of come with me. It's not even implied. Renton's just, I'm out.
You don't think so?
No.
I think there was some.
Or was the offer before? Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I think the offer
was in the bar, and Spud wasn't into it. So I think at this point, Renton's like, no.
Yeah, and he knows he's taking a chance here. I mean, he knows he's not the hero in the story at all. And he talks about how, you know, he's justified it to himself in all these different ways. That was just a minor betrayal, how they'd outgrown each other. But, you know, when it all comes down to it, he ripped him off. And he justifies it, you know, like Begbie, he couldn't give a shit about him. And Sick Boy, well, he'd have done the same if he'd had
if he'd have thought of it first. Yeah.
But he did feel sorry for Spud, because Spud never hurt anybody. Except maybe the lady's sheets. And one breakfast. But that's where we have the bookend monologue.
So why did I do it? I could offer a million answers, all false. The truth is that I'm a bad person, but that's going to change. I'm going to change. This is the last of that sort of thing. And I'm cleaning up and I'm moving on, going straight and choosing life. I'm looking forward to it already. I'm going to be just like you. The job, the family, the fucking big television, the washing machine, the car, the compact disc and electrical tin opener, good health, low cholesterol, dental insurance, mortgage, starter home, leisure wear, luggage, three-piece suite, DIY, game shows, junk food, children, walks in the park, 9 to 5, good at golf, washing the car, choice of sweaters, family Christmas, index pension, tax exemption, clearing the gutters, getting by, looking ahead, the day you die.
And we end with seeing that he's left money for Spud in the safety deposit box.
In the best, most stupid, shitting grin.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it kind of ends on the whole, you know, 80s kind of like, rah, seize the day kind of thing. But yeah, you've gone through quite a bit to get to that place. So do you want to hear
yes, 2 degrees? The 6 degrees. The 2 degrees?
Well, Trainspotting, featuring as Sick Boy, Johnny Lee Miller. Who had been married to and was in the movie Hackers with Angelina Jolie. Who is in 2006 The Good Shepherd with Keir Dullea, who is Dr. Dave Bowman in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Ba-da-da! So, Brother Jay, your judgment.
This is still a great movie. It holds up pretty well.
Brother Drew, was it worth it?
This movie, even 20 years later, is still worth your time. You know, it's on TV from time to time, on a movie channel. So I've seen the first part, the fun part, many, many times, and I was very familiar with it. But I had forgotten the whole second half of it, sort of post-forced detox. You know, I'd always remember the horrifying baby crawling on the ceiling scene. But I'd forgotten kind of the caper after that and what happened at the end. I realized while I was halfway through this movie that I actually didn't remember how it ended.
There's, and some of the best cinematography when he is when Renton overdoses, mm-hmm. and he's, you know, he just fades into the carpet.
Yep.
And that whole sequence.
Yeah, and they hold that perspective of him in the carpet all the way up until he gets the anti-drugs,
the Narcan.
Yeah.
Yeah, so cuz he's, you know, really he's clinging to life. He's basically already 6 feet under and they're just barely be able to pull him out.
But yeah, this is a well-crafted movie, and it's certainly worth your time because you get to see really the beginning of the careers of so many stars, you know, from the filmmaker to the actors. Yeah, this is a great movie and definitely worth a watch and a rewatch.
And it's got a good message too. I mean, for what it is, it doesn't glamorize heroin in any way. I mean, it shows everything, and the only way that Renton comes out is to, like, you know, get off the heroin, get away from his friends. So if you're looking to turn it into a Hallmark movie, you'd have to cut like 25 minutes of footage from it.
Well, even at the end, there's no, I don't know about you, I had no confidence that Renton was actually going to be okay and stay sober. No.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. You give someone with a drug problem a whole bunch of cash.
Yeah.
Scary stuff. So, but yeah, no, I like this movie quite a bit. And after watching a couple of heavy movies, I consider this a little bit lighter, except for all the baby stuff.
Yeah.
But I guess because I'd seen the baby stuff before, it wasn't all that shocking.
And to the credit of the movie, they didn't go very realistic with the dead baby.
No.
Which is good, because that would have been really hard to take.
And there'd be no need for it. It's kind of like with the Fish Called Wanda dead dog. Like, you get the idea. It's already going to be horrific. You don't need to see a photorealistic baby.
Right. I mean, watching the reactions of the people around it was tough enough.
Also, I find it amazing in watching this movie that the story was crammed into 93 minutes.
Oh, it moves along. I like it.
Yes. But I do recommend subtitles.
Yeah.
There is a lot of great dialogue that if you're not as in tuned with the United Kingdom accents as Jason is, you will miss a lot.
Yeah, I agree. Let me take a real quick break again, and then we'll convene for housekeeping. Not in a Creepy Way, we'll be back after these messages.
You don't have to be lonely. FireIsOnly.com.
As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back.
I'm reading a book, and I thought of you. Actually, I've thought of you several times when it's actually an audiobook I'm listening to. The book is called Atomic Accidents. It's a history of all the nuclear meltdowns and disasters from the Ozark Mountains to Fukushima.
Mm.
And it's terrifying.
I assume there's a big section on Chernobyl.
I haven't got there yet.
Oh, Chernobyl is a peach of a story.
Yeah,
that's great. They had such a brilliant design for that reactor. they were like, you know what? Let's make a breeder type reactor, but we're going to do better than the Americans. We're going to make one where you don't have to shut it down to refuel it. You can just refuel it hot. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I'm just amazed in all the, like, they're talking about, like, the reprocessing plants now, or they are scrubbing chemicals, and it never occurs to them that, no, we don't want to have to do this slowly or in small batches, so we're just going to pour everything into a big pot and stir it. And then suddenly they get, you know, the blue flash, and they're all radiated and dead. It just amazes me that I think it terrifies me more than anything that they're talking about when they are testing some of the early reactors and, you know, in 2.9 milliseconds, it goes from 14 watts of power to 19 billion watts of power. That energy is just there. Also the fact that they tried to make a nuclear engine powered jet when the Navy started to get their nuclear submarine technology, the Air Force didn't want to be left out of that gig.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, they actually had jet engines that were powered by nuclear engines, but they couldn't get them small enough to get them on a plane, nor could they get them shielded enough to let the crews live through a flight.
Well, don't they have some sort of nuclear capability on the space stations?
Probably.
Did both of you get to see the blue glow in Missouri?
Nope, I missed it by a day.
You missed it?
I did.
Yeah, speaking of reactors, I don't know if you guys are aware, but did you know the Army back in the day had a program where they were trying to develop a portable tactical nuclear reactor that they could bring to different battlefields to power up everything they needed to very quickly?
I did not know that.
They decided to test the prototype kind of in the middle of nowhere at a little place called Fort Greely, Alaska.
Ah. Yeah. And Fort Greely has fed your family for years.
Yeah. Now it's... they almost closed it back in the early 2000s. Fort Greely, it was part of their base realignment and closure program, until they decided to really ramp it back up for a missile defense program. But I think the reactor is still there, encased in concrete.
Wasn't there a plan to create a deep water port in Nome via a nuclear detonation, and also a plan to make a highway to southeast through the mountains using a series of nuclear bombs?
I hadn't heard the highway one, but yeah, certainly the Nome one.
Yeah, kind of crazy.
I love nuclear power.
It's great till it's not, but really everything is.
Yeah, but I can't wait till you get the chapter on Chernobyl. I know quite a bit about that one. It was due to a safety test. That's what what precipitated the meltdown.
Yeah, I read a lot about it already, just because I find it fascinating. Because I was going to, about 3 years ago, I was actually going to go and take a Chernobyl tour. So,
yeah. I want to say it was the reactor model was an RBMK-1000.
Sounds right.
Excellent.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong?
Have you seen, either of you seen the movie Chernobyl Diaries?
No.
No.
It's a goofy horror movie, which at the end, it turns into a goofy horror movie right at the very end, but the beginning is pretty great, because it talks about, it's a group of people that are trying to go on these, like an adventure excursion that's not strictly legal. So they go through this guide, because they're already in Eastern Europe, and so they're going to go visit
Pripyat.
And assuming that they can't actually film there, they did a really good job with, because it all the sets look exactly like the photos of like the old, and it's like not really an amusement park as much as it's like a big playground for kids and like this big apartment block that's just empty.
Well, I think they can go and film there. I don't think they're supposed to, but I think people get in there anyway and do it.
Oh, no. Yeah, people go and tour it. But, of course, that's the premise of the story is they're not supposed to be there, so it's a little harder to get out and things happen. And so what is it, a book you're reading? Is that what?
Atomic Accidents.
Oh, excellent. Light reading. Is it audible or are you reading it?
It's audible.
Oh.
It's audible. It's fascinating, but it starts... You know, the book starts in the late 1800s or late 1900s when they talk about how people were crashing rail trains into each other head on for money, for entertainment. And it was a spectator thing.
Yeah, I just heard that.
So that's the opening of this book, because some of the people needed to find a way to make money, and so they were prospecting and for material, and they stumbled across a cave that had this shiny metal that made them all very sick. And so just a strange turn of events, but it's a terrifying and awesome book all in the same thing. So
does it talk about a phrase called tickling the dragon's tail?
Yes.
You know,
I love to work that into conversation whenever I can.
Say, I'm going to repeat what I said. Call back to last episode where I explained that we don't have to explain this to our parents. They grew up and like lived during the 70s. They invented that shit.
They talk a lot about, you know, the scramming the reactor, and there's a lot about criticality and subcriticality You know, it's just it's got some very dense science to it, which I'm finding fascinating since I only understand very little of it. But talking about the different types of reactors and why sodium cooled reactors are not the best, but you know how pouring water, you know, on fires aren't good either, because it pulls the oxygen out and then you're left with hydrogen gas, which, you know, has a propensity to explode. So, and then when you get graphite hot enough, it just burns.
Yeah, that was one of the terrifying aspects of the Chernobyl meltdown.
It's the graphite being on fire.
Yeah, not much they could do about it. Except try and smother it.
They are still just going into Fukushima with robots, right?
Well, I think the robots, they keep sending in robots, but I think the last robot just died again, so they pretty much just said fuck it.
Yeah, and that was potentially super bad.
They have an epidemic of radioactive wildlife, right?
I can only imagine fish is going to be bad for a while, even over here. But Chernobyl had that radioactive wildlife too. Like Finland had radioactive reindeer because of Chernobyl.
Well, I think that there's a story of the wild boars around Pripyat that are all radioactive.
Yeah, I think Finland was the only reason the civilized world found out about Chernobyl, because the radioactive cloud hit the the stratosphere.
Their monitoring stations. Yeah.
Yeah. And ended up going over Finland.
And luckily, the Finns have no love for the Soviets.
Not very many people did in the 80s.
Historically, not so great. So, Brother Jew, any housekeeping? Oh, did you see I put the link to the Mustang suit?
I did see that, yeah. Yeah, it's not quite the same model I had trouble with, but similar.
Yeah, do you know how much that bad boy costs? You actually probably do know how much it costs.
I have no idea.
Well, it's part of a two-piece system. I guess there's a separate life vest thing or life ring that makes it part of this overall system. But just the suit part of it is $2,700.
Sounds right. The ones we use, it's actually a three-part system. There's an inner liner just to help you get into the suit. So it's like this cotton... giant cotton onesie that you get into, and that's supposed to help you kind of slide into the big waterproof suit. Yeah, and then you have to wear a little life preserver around your neck. It's a deal. I think I mentioned to you the time before when we were talking about how I was leaving a platform one time and it felt like the helicopter just decided to tip off the side instead of going up. which I'm sure it didn't. It just felt that way to me. But that was a time when I thought, well, we were told that it was, I don't remember the exact times, but for instance, we were told to be ready to depart at 3:30, and we finished our work around 2. So we were like doing paperwork and checking our email, and then we got the notice at like 2:45 that the helicopter was going to be there in 5 minutes. And the helicopter does not wait. So if you're not ready, you miss it. So that meant we had to do the whole thing and. Too quick an amount of time to be safe for your muscles.
Like in Alaska water, there's not a big margin for error.
Nope, you've only got a couple minutes.
Yeah, best case scenario, you better get rescued fast.
Indeed.
So. Did the suits have locator beacons?
No.
They're reflective though, so that'll help.
Oh, they'll find the body.
They're very bright. Our suits are orange, by the way, not yellow. So I'll clear that up.
Well, and the helicopter itself should have a locator beacon.
Oh, yeah.
That should automatically deploy if there's...
If it's not, 200, 300 feet under the water.
Well, there's that.
Well, it's a heavily trafficked area. It's not like we're out in the wilderness. If it goes down, people are going to know pretty close to where it is.
Well, that's good.
But let's not talk about helicopter crashes, though. Let's move on to something else.
So, any other housekeeping?
No, I'm really looking forward to next week's movie.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the best Bond movie to date, right?
Depending on who you talk to.
Sure. I may drink heavily to watch it. I don't know.
Well, I've never seen it before, so I think it'll be fascinating.
Yeah, maybe it'll be fantastic.
There's a lot of love for it.
I did have something to bring up. You know how last week you were mentioning Javier Bardem said he didn't know why they picked him for the role for No Country for Old Men because he didn't speak English well and he didn't like violent parts?
Yes.
But Skyfall. He's super violent and lots of speaking English.
Well, Skyfall was later.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah, and it's not... It wasn't quite as violent. It had more comic book violence than No Country for Old Men. No Country for Old Men was just straight up, like, blood and gut violence. Like, the difference between a Brett Ratner and a Sam Peckinpah.
Have either of you seen Before Night Falls?
Nope.
No.
That's a great movie. It's kind of a tough watch, but it's a great movie.
Is it the Javier Bardem movie?
Yes. I think it's a movie about being a gay poet persecuted in Cuba.
Oh.
Jeez.
Yeah, it seems a little heavy.
So it's an uplifting movie.
Yeah.
No. not really. But he's very good in it.
I have a podcast recommendation. If you're familiar with the How Did This Get Made podcast, it's where they pick a relatively big movie that is just absurd. So they kind of pick at it. And there's, three comedians. It's Paul Scheer and June Diane Raphael and Jason Mantzoukas. And usually there's another guest and they pick apart a movie. Well, I think they put out an episode every 2 weeks with a new movie, but in the middle... Yeah, every other week, they do a like a preview episode that kind of tells you what movie they're doing and then kind of gets you warmed up. Plus, they take fan letters or whatever and talk about stuff like that. Well, this latest episode was a bonus How Did This Get Made with an interview with Mel Brooks. And it was one of, I think it was either an intern or, I think maybe it was the guy who works with Slash Film that goes and does like oral histories of all the movies that they review and how this kid made, where he goes and tries to find actors that actually participated in it. And they had just done the movie Solar Babies, which is a Brooks Film movie. And it's really fascinating. It's like a half an hour interview, maybe 33 minutes, 35 minutes. But Mel Brooks is still a hell of a storyteller, and it's still really fascinating how Solar Babies got made, and it's just, it's pretty great. And the guy, the interviewer, for the most part, just lets Mel Brooks talk, which is what you need to do when you have someone like Mel Brooks.
Right.
Yes, minimal encouragers, and just let him tell his story.
I don't think I've heard of Solar Babies.
Yeah, it's... I'm trying to think of... It's got a great cast, if I remember correctly. But it was a dreadful movie. Critically panned.
1986.
Yeah, I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but his story is worth listening to, whether or not you've seen the movie.
Oh my God. Really?
Look, what's... So, cast. Who's the cast?
Well, first, Jamie Gertz.
Yes.
Jason Patrick.
Yes.
Lucas Haas. Peter DeLuise, Adrian Pasdar, Charles Durning, Terrence Mann.
Yeah.
How have I never...
Well, it was before, like, when was it? 80 what?
86.
Okay, so a lot of those actors were still pretty young. Like, I don't think, did Jason Patrick, had he broken out yet?
Jamie Gertz,
was this before or after Less Than Zero?
Lost Boys was 1988, right?
So, yeah. Anyway, fascinating cast.
Wow.
But, yeah, How Did This Get Made is all about the producer aspect of it. Because that's why, you know, Mel Brooks started Brooks Films so he could, you know, because it would never let him direct a drama. So... his friend basically said, hey, you just set up your own film company and you can produce and therefore kind of like direct sort of secondhand.
It's Jason Patrick's first movie.
Okay, yeah.
He had it. Well, it's his first cinematic movie. He had a TV movie before that, but it's his first movie. His second movie was Lost Boys.
Yeah. Did you know that Brooks Films was the producers for The Elephant Man?
No, I
yeah,
didn't know
he's
that.
Done a lot of serious movies through Brooks Films. So it's not all just Blazing Saddles, and I tried to watch The History of the World Part 1.
Yeah.
It's kind of painful to watch.
Well, Blazing Saddles is, I don't want to besmirch it. Blazing Saddles is a great movie, but it's hard to watch sometimes.
It's a product of its time, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, I recently watched Young Frankenstein, which is hilariously great still.
Maybe because that was already kind of a... Well, I guess they're all period pieces.
You know, but I'm also... You know, High Anxiety is one of my favorite Mel Brooks movies, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't really like... I don't like Blazing Saddles. I really like High Anxiety, but maybe that's because I've already seen it 84 times.
Yeah, probably because you've been around me and I've watched it.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So have you seen it because I made you watch it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. It's not like we had that many. Well, I guess we did have that many TVs, but not a lot of VCRs initially. So,
well, and what about Spaceballs?
Well, yeah, we're going to revisit that here pretty soon.
Yeah, I haven't seen Spaceballs in a long time, but I remember really liking it.
I think we three saw Spaceballs in the theater together.
Oh, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to, because, you know, Star Wars is now back in the zeitgeist. It's going to be still as funny, I hope.
Yeah. I think we all do.
Yeah. But, you know, apart from those two movies, I don't know that I've really enjoyed a Mel Brooks movie.
To Be or Not to Be?
I don't think I've seen it. Like Robin Hood Men in Tights, I was like, it's not that great.
Well, it's definitely a certain kind of humor. Like how our mother hates the Three Stooges because it's just the whole genre of comedy is just not for her.
Yeah. I remember really liking The 2000-Year-Old Man. Like I don't remember it being like laugh out loud funny, but I remember it being interesting.
Oh, I remember it being laugh out loud funny. And the 2000-year-old man, that's Carl Reiner as much as Mel Brooks. I mean, you know, Carl Reiner,
they feed off each other.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And I have, I think, every recorded iteration of 2000-year-old man. Because I mean, I have the 2000-year-old man at the year 2000 where they recorded it again. But of course, you know, it's a lot of it is just improv. So. And then I remember they had a 2000-year-old man cartoon. Somebody animated it.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Yeah. Because 2000-year-old man was a comedy album.
Yeah.
Mm. I just remember like the squiggly line cartoon.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Carl Reiner's autobiography is really good. I can't remember what it's called, of course, now. But it's very interesting because I can't remember where he was in the military. I mean, I know both of them were in the military, but I think like one of the things that they did to pass the time and their downtime is like Carl Reiner would tell a story or like read from a book and everybody would kind of gather around. So it was a different time. And then again, Carl Reiner was, I think he produced or was a showrunner for the Dick Van Dyke Show.
The autobiography, I Remember Me?
Yes.
That's a great title.
But, yeah, I'm sure Mel Brooks has an autobiography as well. That guy just sounds, like, super fascinating. Anyway, so anything else, or we're on Her Majesty's Secret Service?
It's going to be great.
It will be. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.